Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear from State Representative Shirley Ringo of Moscow speaking to the Moscow chapter of the American Association of University Women yesterday. But first, this news. Responders at the site of an Interstate 5 bridge collapse at the Skagit River, about 60 miles north of Seattle, say they don't believe anyone else is in the water, but are continuing to search just to be sure. Authorities now say two vehicles went into the river at about 7 p.m. last night, down from the estimated four earlier reported. According to Washington State Department of Transportation spokesperson Bart Reese, state inspectors say an oversized truck carrying drilling equipment southbound hit an overhead truss, triggering the collapse of the bridge over the Skagit River. One of the bridge's four spans dropped into the water, which is about 15 feet deep at that part of the bridge. The truck was carrying a tall load of drilling equipment from Alberta to Vancouver, Washington. Driver William Scott of Spruce Grove, Alberta, gave a blood test and was not arrested. Scott works for Edmonton-based Mullen Trucking. The Seattle Times reports the collapsed Skagit River Bridge was considered to be nothing out of the ordinary for a bridge of that type. Engineers were not overly worried about the bridge, and structural inspectors rated the condition of the bridge as average for a structure its age. But bridges which were built in the 1950s were constructed in a manner called fracture critical. That means the structure would fall apart if one critical component is broken. Steel truss bridges like the Skagit River Bridge are built in a complicated network of interdependent parts. In 1992, the National Bridge Inventory gave the Skagit Bridge a structurally deficient rating. An $8.3 million construction effort brought the Skagit Bridge's rating up to functionally obsolete by 1994. The National Bridge Inventory says this is an improved rating, but still not considered adequate for Interstate 5 traffic flow. On August 1, 2007, 13 people were killed when an interstate bridge in Minneapolis, Minnesota collapsed during rush hour when traffic was backed up on the bridge. The structure collapsed, dropping dozens of vehicles into the water. In addition to the dead, 145 people were hurt. But unlike the Skagit River Bridge, the Minnesota Bridge was considered a decaying structure. The I-5 bridge's superstructure was considered in fair condition, and the underwater substructure was rated satisfactory by the National Bridge Inventory. Washington State bridges are required to have a 2-year inspection cycle, as well as a 5-year underwater inspection cycle. Structural ratings combine traffic carrying capacity and structural soundness. Comparisons to other bridges along Interstate 5, such as the Alaskan Way Viaduct, are noteworthy. The Skagit River Bridge had a 57.4 rating, while the Alaskan Viaduct has a 9 rating. Responders took three people out of the cold water with minor injuries after two vehicles and a trailer fell into the river last night. The pickup with the recreational trailer was driven by 47-year-old Dan Sly of Oak Harbor. Sly and his wife, Sally, were on their way to a Memorial Day weekend camping trip. Sly said he's just happy to be alive. Outside of an area hospital where he and the other injured were taken, Sly said, "You talk miracles. I don't know what you want to call it. When you're sitting down in the water and all that mangled metal of the bridge, you look around and you pinch yourself." Sly was able to get out of the truck and, despite a separated shoulder, was able to keep his unconscious wife's head out of the water until rescuers pulled them out. The driver of the SUV got himself out of the water before responders arrived. Former head of bridges and structures for Washington Department of Transportation, Jugesh Kapur, told the Seattle Times there are 362 fracture-critical bridges in the state. Kapur said, "It doesn't imply anything bad about the bridge. It just means that if a certain component fails, it can lead to the complete collapse of the bridge." Washington Governor Jay Inslee said today it will cost $15 million to complete short-term repairs of the bridge. It's unknown how long the repairs would take on the bridge that averages 71,000 vehicles per day. U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood allocated $1 million in federal money today to help with the bridge collapse. Interstate 5 travelers are being detoured over a bridge that takes local traffic over the river between the cities of Burlington and Mount Vernon. Another detour is on Washington Route 534 and 9, only taking northbound traffic. A third detour for both northbound and southbound traffic involves using U.S. Highway 20 west of Burlington and local roads to get back to the interstate. The Idaho Department of Parks and Recreation has sold a $500,000 worth of the new $10 per year vehicle passes for the 30 state parks in Idaho. The total number of the new park passes sold so far is 41,389 statewide. The new passes are only available to residents when they register their vehicle at county motor vehicle offices. This is the first year the cheaper $10 passes are available, replacing the $40 annual passes Idaho residents could purchase, which brought in an average of $800,000 per year for the Parks Department. Lawmakers have greatly reduced state funding for the Department of Parks and Recreation over the last 4 years, down from $6.8 million to $1.3 million. Park officials are hopeful sales of the new cheaper passes for Idaho residents will eventually bring in $1.9 million per year. Governor C.L. Butch Otter has said in previous State of the State addresses he wants the Parks Department to be self-sufficient. Out-of-state residents can purchase $40 annual passes at Idaho parks, but the passes available to Idaho residents are only available when registering vehicles at county motor vehicle licensing offices, meaning if someone's vehicle registration expires in midsummer, so will their pass. Kootenai County Assessor Mike McDowell, who oversees the County Department of Motor Vehicles office in Coeur d'Alene, told the Spokesman Review he recommends those who want to go to parks now register their vehicles early ahead of the expiration date, thereby getting a bit more than a full year use of their park pass. The Washington State Patrol says there are 20 cases in which a state crime lab employee failed to process evidence as required, leaving investigations in limbo. Crime lab employee Kevin Fortney resigned in April after he was accused of lying to his boss about doing tests on evidence that he did not do. Washington State Patrol spokesperson Robert Calkins told the Spokesman Review an investigation into Fortney's work at the crime lab in Cheney is almost finished and none of the untested pieces of evidence are missing. Although Fortney likely hurt investigations by not testing the evidence, Calkins said it's unlikely Fortney will be charged with a crime because it does not appear he committed perjury or falsified results. However, the paper reports the quality of evidence has degraded over time and possible investigative trails may have gone cold. 8 of the 20 cases were from Spokane County, and most of those were arson cases over 10 years old. The statute of limitations in Washington for arson is 10 years. Telephone service was disrupted in Moscow and Pullman for more than 8 hours yesterday when a non-Frontier contractor accidentally cut a Frontier fiber optic line between Coeur d'Alene and Moscow late yesterday morning. The outage affected 911 service as well as some ATMs and debit credit card machines, causing some businesses to shut down for the day. Service was restored around 8 p.m. The Daily News reported calls to Frontier's general manager were not returned. Attorneys with the Corrections Corporation of America have filed a motion asking a judge to seal documents in a lawsuit against them brought by inmates at the Idaho Correctional Center. Corrections Corporation of America, the world's largest private prison company, operates but does not own the state's correctional center south of Boise. The inmates contend chronic understaffing and mismanagement at the prison created dangerous conditions, resulting in attacks on 8 of them. Corrections Corporation of America said in court documents, information in the case must be kept secret to protect security at the prison. The company wants information identifying their employees, company policies, inmates' criminal and medical information, and information on the attacks on inmates to remain secret. The Moscow School Board and the Moscow Education Association failed to reach a tentative agreement last night after a four-hour public discussion of contract terms and a closed session reviewing the Education Association proposal. Board member Margaret Dibble criticized the MEA proposal, calling it out of date, confusing, and difficult, and asked the union to rewrite it in a more coherent fashion. The MEA agreed to rewrite the proposal, although Representative Mike Ware defended it, saying most of the language was from the proposal the MEA and the school board had been working on last year when the so-called Luna laws allowed negotiations only over salary and fringe benefits, but disallowed negotiations over issues such as class size and teacher safety. When Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna's Students Come First laws were repealed in a statewide referendum last November, Ware said 98% of teachers voted to return to that prior negotiation as a starting point. The Washington State University Board of Regents yesterday agreed to limit tuition increases for students to 2%. For the 2013 to 2014 school year, despite the fact the legislature has not yet set its budget amount for WSU. The Regents hiked the services and activities fee by $10 and added $3 to the Student Recreation Center fee. They also approved construction projects for a wine science center on the Tri-Cities campus and a renovation of the Chief Joseph Village apartments in Pullman. The Regents agreed to set up an Office of Commercialization tasked with making money from the university's intellectual property and removed that function from the Washington State Research Foundation. WSU President Elson Floyd told the Regents he is optimistic money can be found for faculty and staff salary increases. Floyd said, going 5 years without a raise has caused some top faculty to leave, including five College of Engineering professors who left last week. Given the outlook for state money for the university, Floyd said, the unfunded liability of pay increases will have to be funded by WSU itself. In response to a claim by fired University of Idaho football coach Rob Akey, the university is denying they owe him up to $105,000, the second half of his annual salary. Akey was fired with four games remaining in the football season last fall. In court documents, the university maintained it followed the terms of Akey's contract in the firing, and whether or not Akey participated in all required media programs and public appearances is open to interpretation. Akey was paid the first half of his $210,000 contract prior to the opening of the 2012 football season. He was to be paid the second half when he completed the season. Despite below-average mountain snowpack, most high-elevation roads and passes remained blocked by snow in Idaho. Holiday travelers planning to go to the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest are advised to go to the forest's website alerts page before planning camping or backpacking trips. The U.S. Census Bureau reports the southwestern Idaho cities of Star, Meridian, and Eagle grew by the most in 2012. Star grew by 3.4%, Meridian by 3.3%, and Eagle by 2.9%. The city of Boise's population grew by 2.2%. The agency reports the state's population was 1,595,728 at the end of 2012, up 0.8% over 2011. Idaho cities had 1.1 million people, up 1% in 2012. Cities account for 69% of the state's population, up from 59% in 1990. The rural population of Idaho, defined as the number of people living outside incorporated city limits, increased by 0.3% in 2012. 88 cities lost population in 2012, but only three cities with more than 10,000 people. Those were Rexburg, Blackfoot, and Mountain Home. The cities that lost at least 2.5% of their population in 2012 were Arco, Idaho City, Horseshoe Bend, Butte City, Crouch, Fairfield, and Dubois. The U.S. Census Bureau also released statistics this week saying Idaho was the second lowest in the nation for per capita student spending for the third year in a row. The latest figures are for fiscal year 2011, in which Idaho spent $6,824 per student. Only Utah spent less that year. Washington ranked 30th, spending $9,483 per student. We now go to our featured segment. Democratic Representative Shirley Ringo of Moscow spoke to a meeting of the Moscow chapter of the American Association of University Women at the University in Best Western last night. Here's a portion of Shirley Ringo's talk.
During every legislative session, when the Joint Finance Committee meets, they adopt a projection for what the revenue will be for the rest of the fiscal year we're in. And fiscal year 13 ends June 30th. And then we also normally project what we would expect the revenue to be like in the next year. So now we're learning how our projections were for this year because we get real information that comes in, so we know. And the report I recently received is that April general fund collections were $56.4 million ahead of the forecast. And the year-to-date collections are $79 million more than the forecast.
$79.
So it's rather typical for the Joint Finance Committee to be conservative and typically lowball what those projections are, because in this fiscally conservative atmosphere that we have, there's not really a desire on the part of the majority to spend a lot of money. So the thing that seems to suit them best is to pretend it's not going to be there and kind of make a lower projection. Of course, then we don't overspend either.
True.
So
yeah.
There are two sides to that. But I've read recently some comments that our governor has made that he doesn't want to hear too much about spending these monies. To me, when we see the revenue looking brighter than we thought it was going to be, it would look like we have some immediate places where we can put that to work. That not only is prudent to take care of our investments, but also it leads to employment. Another concern that I would have has to do with how we pay our public employees and our school teachers. When we had the downturn in the economy, the public employees really gave up a great deal in their compensation to help us balance the books. And one thing that we asked them to do was to take voluntary unpaid furloughs, which they did. And a figure that I obtained during our last session was that collectively the public employees gave up over $12 million of pay by taking voluntary unpaid furloughs, all to help us through these hard times. But now that we see things getting brighter, it surprises me that we're not more aggressive trying to do something for them. And I think the year of the downturn, they lost 5% in compensation. And since then, between 2009 and now, their raises have been 0%, except for the year we're in now, they got 2%. But while we made all the plans for this next year, none of them included any raises for public employees.
None?
None. Well, 0% for this year for public employees, right? Now, school teachers, at the time of the downturn, there were two things that they gave up that were fairly substantial. One was on their pay grid. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Some of you are, I'm sure. But their pay grid has several cells, and the cell that a given teacher is in is determined by their years of experience and the amount of education that they have. So the legislature in 2009 simply mandated that all the teachers back up 2 years on their experience grid. And so now what this involves is the amount of money we send out to school districts to pay their teachers. So if the school districts could find a way to make up for that, they could. But otherwise, the teachers had to take that decrease. And I just took one cell and tracked it for 4 years and found it was a loss of $8,000. Now, in this year, we did a good thing. We restored those two steps. So we moved everybody back. So that was good. The thing that we did not do was we also did an across-the-board decrease of 8.35% on the salary schedule for teachers, and we have not restored that. So, you know, those are two things that I really think we should address if we find our revenue better and if we have evidence that it's going to hold up so that we can sustain making that investment. This year in the legislature was quite interesting just because of having many more new members than we have typically had in the past. In the House, I think it was close to 30 people were new out of 70, and that's quite a change. And even, now I'm not going to try to be too partisan here, but you, most of you probably know I'm a Democrat, and even in our smaller caucus, you know, we had enough new people that the dynamic was interesting. And they were all very nice, and just, you know, it seemed to me we'll benefit from a little bit of experience. Now, on the Joint Finance Committee, I had been used to working with Wendy Jaquette, who is from Ketchum, Nicole LeFevre, who's from Boise, Diane Bilyeu from Pocatello, and myself. And we really worked together very smoothly, frequently would go to dinner together and talk about what things we would like to try to emphasize, and with our small numbers, you know, what could we get done, what should we try to get done. And those three women were all gone this year. They all decided not to run again. So I have three new Democrat colleagues. And I would say, although they're all very capable, we haven't yet reached that working relationship. And I know that'll come, but it's just a little more challenging. With the other three, I think we all pretty much knew where each of us would come down on things and had a great deal in common philosophically, even though we represented different parts of the state. So that's just part of the dynamic. Year to year, you don't always have the same faces to work with. So, the major issues that we addressed or didn't address. One was the health insurance exchange, part of, I guess, that President Obama has decided he's comfortable with us calling that Obamacare. So, that's one of the components that we needed to address. The potential is to try to make insurance, some form of insurance, as affordable and as accessible as possible, since the plan really involves trying to have everybody have some kind of insurance. Could be Medicare, Medicaid, if that's a person's situation, or something that that person purchases. That was just kind of an interesting thing to go through, because big business really wanted us to pass the legislation to get that insurance exchange in place. IACI, the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, was definitely behind it. And it was going to be very, very close in both the Senate and House when we voted on that, because frankly there is a significant conservative portion of the majority party, if you can believe this, that is not embracing Obamacare, and they would have liked to block this if they could. In fact, the year before, they wouldn't touch it in hopes that the Supreme Court would throw it out. So there was the interesting dynamic was that they couldn't have passed it without the Democrat votes. They couldn't have. And we're never in that situation, believe me. Our little small group to actually be in a position where our votes were needed for something that certain people wanted to have done. I wanted with a passion to leverage that to try to get some concessions for education. You know, at least you can pretend you're not going to vote for it unless unless you get a little cooperation on some of the issues that are really important to you. But with our new legislators and experience that they had or didn't have, it wasn't possible to get a lot of force behind that effort. But we did stop one thing that that I thought was very bad for education. So that was something, but a lot of bad stuff went through. So getting to education. I'm sure you all were very well informed about the three propositions that were voted on in the last election. And they were really all three soundly defeated, the LUNA laws that were debated so thoroughly. And so really I firmly believe that with the voters having spoken as they did, it was highly inappropriate for the legislature to reinstate any of those. The governor did put together a committee to talk about how to move forward, but essentially he said Prop 1, which was the teachers union contract negotiations things, he wouldn't mind if people went ahead and worked on legislation for restoring some of that. You know, that just I really have a hard time with our having done that, because the voters did speak. And I think that it deserved the same consideration that the other two propositions did. So the one thing that we were able to stop was a piece of legislation that would have essentially said you can negotiate, but if you don't have an agreement by June 10th, then the board can impose an agreement. Well, that's not really what you call negotiations, because what would you do if you were on the board and you knew you had this June 10th drop dead time and there was something you really didn't want to go through? Just stall. So they didn't do that. But of the things that were passed, and there were a few of them, the one that I thought was the worst was one that stated that if a school district pays their teachers at a rate that's better than the state salary schedule, then at any time they want, they can reduce the pay of their teachers and shorten contracts without declaring a financial emergency or having to justify it in any way. Now, I would assume if the Moscow School Board tried something like that, they'd have to deal with some angry community members that wouldn't appreciate having the teachers treated that way, but still, it's a pretty bad law when you think about it. Now, so what is the state salary schedule like? Well, it's really a floor. The lowest pay we can pay a teacher in the state of Washington, or state of Idaho now, is $30,500 a year. And the top number on the state salary schedule is a little over $46,000. So that means that somebody that comes in, sticks with the district for 13 or more years, and gets either a doctorate or a master's degree plus 30 hours of credit, makes $16,000 more for the effort. And that doesn't seem like very much to me, especially when you think that the number of hours of credit that it would take to go to a university and get that master's degree plus 30 or that doctorate would cost the person $20,000 out of pocket dollars. So I think it's a shabby way to treat teachers, even if a district doesn't do it. And I don't think, like, I can't see our local districts doing that. But the fact that the legislature said that's okay, to me, is a great disrespect shown for the people that teach our children. So that was unfortunate.
That was Representative Shirley Ringo of Moscow speaking to a meeting of the Moscow chapter of the American Association of University Women at the university in Best Western last night. Ringo represents District 5 in the legislature, which includes all of Latah and Benoit counties. Citizen journalist Brett Haverstick assisted with this story. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear every morning during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114. Or East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or go to the Radio Free Moscow website at krfp.org or radiofreemoscow.com to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. Remember, all editions of the KRFP Evening Report, plus recordings of local events, are available at the Radio Free Moscow website. Jim Roach and Nancy Casey assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great holiday weekend.